Cooper floored it, and his Mazda seemed to spring to life, lunging forward with so much thrust that Mark's head slammed against the headrest. "Coop, stop!" He wasn't listening. The Mazda was gaining speed, flying past every other car in the three westbound lanes of Newbury Road. A slow-moving truck turned in front of them to enter the gas station. Cooper maneuvered around it at 70 miles per hour, tires squealing. "Cooper! They're still on us!" he said with a quick glance in the mirror. Mark looked back and saw a Chevy. He pulled his cell from his pocket. "Stop driving crazy. I'm dialing 911. "No!" He swung at Mark, knocking the cell from his hand. It disappeared somewhere between the passenger seat and the console. "Damn it, Coop!" Cooper steered to the left lane, as if heading for the mall. The Chevy followed, almost on their bumper. Cooper steered hard right. Horns blasted as the Mazda cut across three lanes and sped onto the interstate on-ramp. Mark's heart was in his throat. The speedometer was pushing 90. The Chevy was right on them. "Fuck!" shouted Cooper. The entry ramp circled around a man-made pond, a typical hole in the ground that fills with spring water after construction crews remove the earth to build an interstate exchange. Cooper was rounding the big sweeping curve at more than double the speed limit. So was the Chevy behind them. Cooper sped up and then hit the brake, trying to teach the tailgaters a lesson. "Cooper!" The stunt was more than Cooper could handle. His Mazda went into a tailspin, and Cooper's overcorrection sent them skidding in circles, completely out of control. In the blur, Mark saw the Chevy speed past them a split second before the Mazda hit the guardrail. The airbag exploded in Mark's face and then collapsed, but the car kept skidding to the opposite side of the ramp. It was like peering out from the center of a spiraling tornado, spinning, swirling. The front end slammed into the opposite guardrail, but momentum carried the car right over the top. The car nearly rolled over, but righted itself and continued down the embankment. Mark's arms flailed and his whole body jerked, his head slamming forward and back against the headrest. The passenger side window exploded into glass pellets that bloodied Mark's face like buckshot. The skidding stopped with an ominous thud, but the impact seemed cushioned as if the battered Mazda had somehow made a soft landing, as if they were drifting in slow motion. A wet sensation enveloped his feet and ankles. Not the hot, wet feeling of blood on his face, but a cooler, almost cold wetness. Water was suddenly everywhere. The pond! Mark splashed his face to clear away the blood. The water was already knee-deep, and still more poured in from every crevice. It had a ghoulish crimson tint of blood, his and his friend's. "Coop!" He didn't respond. Mark unbuckled the driver's side seatbelt and shook him. "Cooper, are you okay?" Mark tried his door handle, but the door was stuck. He reached across and tried the driver's side. No go. The only way out was through the broken passenger side window. He tried to pull Cooper toward him, but Cooper's leg was pinned below the twisted steering wheel. Mark pulled harder. More blood trickled into his eyes, effectively blinding him. The water was rising. The car was sinking. His mind was a fog, but he fought with every ounce of strength to loosen Cooper's trapped foot. The water inched upward over his waist. He felt weak, almost numb. He called for help. "Somebody, please!" But it was barely audible. Mark felt himself slipping away, trying to say his friend's name. Then he slumped over the console. Chapter 34. Jack was in Live Oak for the state attorney's announcement of the criminal indictment. Shortly after 1 p.m., Oliver Bolt appeared on the courthouse steps with his senior trial counsel at his side. Media swarmed around them. Jack and Thea were packed shoulder to shoulder with dozens of other onlookers. Microphones, cameras, and eager reporters captured the state attorney's remarks, which he read from a prepared statement.
Today, a Suwanee County grand jury has heard sworn testimony relating to the death of Jamal Cousin, and it has returned an indictment against Mark Towson and Cooper Bartlett.
The crowd cheered, with demonstrators thrusting posters and fists triumphantly into the warm afternoon air. Some had been holding vigil outside the courthouse since the start of the grand jury proceedings, most notably the Dream Defenders, an organization started after the acquittal of private security guard George Zimmerman in the fatal shooting of a 17-year-old black teenager. Posters proclaiming "I am Trayvon Martin" had been part of a historic 21-day sit-in at the state capitol, and some of those seasoned participants had resurrected the old signs, adding, "I am Jamal Cousin."
"Count one is against Mr. Towson only," said the prosecutor, looking straight at the cameras. "The charge is murder in the first degree."
The crowd cheered even louder.
"Count two charges Mr. Towson and Mr. Bartlett with conspiracy to commit murder."
Still more cheering, which morphed into a unified chant of "Justice for Jamal! Justice for Jamal!" It continued for another minute, drowning out the state attorney's reference to the lesser included charges in the indictment. Jack tried to show no reaction. After murder one, there was only one way to make things worse, and Jack sensed that the state attorney was headed in that direction.
"In today's world, I should not have to stand before you and condemn lynching. If we are to stop this backslide to the darkest chapters in our nation's history, we must learn from history. Some say that the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime. History shows, however, that the death penalty is a proven deterrent to lynching."
Here it comes, thought Jack.
"The historical evidence is that lynching stopped only when the use of capital punishment increased," Bolt added. "Therefore, in accordance with the findings of the grand jury, the charge against Mr. Towson is capital murder, for which the state of Florida will seek the death penalty."
It was the proverbial showstopper. The 4th of July and New Year's Eve on the courthouse steps. The state attorney stepped aside to allow his senior trial counsel a moment in the spotlight, but the crowd wasn't listening, and even the reporters on the front line had trouble hearing. Marsha Weller's remarks were boilerplate anyway. The obligatory promise that the defendants are cloaked with the presumption of innocence and have the right to trial by jury, not by news conference. Bolt had the final word.
"We will not comment further on the process and will certainly not comment on the evidence. Thank you for being here."
The prosecutors turned and walked back toward the courthouse. The crowd gave them an ovation worthy of Super Bowl champs, and the media followed them all the way up the stairs to the courthouse entrance, peppering them with questions that went unanswered.
"Let's go," said Jack.
"You don't want to say anything?" asked Theo.
"Later. I'm not going to hold a press conference with 1,000 people booing me."
Jack hurried down the steps, and only then did he notice the pickup truck parked directly across the street. It was wedged between media vans, and in the bed of the pickup was a big red, white, and blue campaign sign, "Re-elect Oliver Bolt, your state attorney."
"No offense," said Theo, "but if I lived here, I'd vote for him."
Jack stopped on the sidewalk at the base of the steps.
"That's not cool."
"Neither is lynching."
Jack looked away, then back, but he couldn't quell all the anger in his tone.
"Bolt is rewriting history, Theo. Lynching didn't stop in this country because white people feared the death penalty. Lynching disappeared because judges started ordering the swift execution of black men. Capital punishment didn't deter lynch mobs. It replaced them. Why do you think I spent 4 years of my life trying to get you off death row? Mr. Switek?
Jack turned and saw a reporter running toward him. The media's fixation on the prosecution had ended, and he'd been spotted. Jack started walking toward his car, but the reporter caught up and shoved her microphone toward him. The cameraman jostled with Theo for space on the sidewalk as Jack quickened the pace.
Is there any news on Mark Towson's accident?
The reporter asked. What accident?
I just heard that Mark Towson was in a serious car crash. Is it true?
Jack stopped at his car.
I don't know anything about that, but thank you for telling me.
She continued to fire questions as Jack climbed into the passenger seat and closed the door. Theo drove off. Jack immediately called his client's cell but got no answer. He tried Mark's father and got through.
I was just about to call you,
said Tucker, his voice laden with concern.
I'm at Shan's hospital now.
So it's true. Mark was in an accident.
Yes.
Bad one. He's in surgery right now, and we think he'll be okay. He was with Cooper Bartlett.
Is Cooper there at the same hospital?
Tucker paused long enough for Jack to know what he was going to say.
Cooper is dead.
Jack swallowed the news.
Okay. Call me as soon as you know more on Mark. Don't speak to the media. I'm on my way.
Chapter 35. The door opened and Mark's father invited Jack into the hospital room.
Hold it, said the officer.
Two guards were posted in the hallway outside Mark's room. He was officially under arrest. A metal-detecting wand was run up and down Jack's body, confirming no weapons.
You're good, said the officer, allowing Jack entry.
Surgery to remove Mark's ruptured spleen and stop the internal bleeding had lasted almost an hour. He'd spent another hour in recovery before being wheeled in a gurney to a private room. Jack had been waiting in the hallway to give the Towson family time alone. He closed the door behind him, and both Mark's mother and sister gave him a hug when he entered.
How's he doing?
Asked Jack.
Going to be fine.
Doctor said a few days in the hospital, and then he can go... Tucker stopped himself, clearly wishing he could say home.
To jail, said Mark.
Jack stepped toward the hospital bed. Mark was in an elevated position, midway between sitting up and lying flat on his back. A plastic IV tube connected the vein in his forearm to a plastic bag of fluids that hung from the pole. A bedside machine monitored his vitals, a modest beep with each heartbeat. The red marks and abrasions on his face were due to shattered glass, Jack assumed.
I'd like to speak with Mark alone, Jack told the family.
They obliged and filed out. Jack stood at the bed rail. Mark turned his head and gazed out the window.
Cooper's dead.
I know, said Jack. I'm sorry.
Are people happy?
It was the first truly cynical thing Jack had heard Mark say.
I don't think so.
Mark's gaze returned to Jack.
You know how Jamal Cousins' phone records show that he received a text message from Cooper's phone?
Yeah.
Cooper admitted to me that he sent it. Nobody took his phone and pretended to be him.
So Bain sent the one from your phone, said Jack, but not the one from Cooper's.
That's what it comes down to.
Did Cooper say what he wrote in his text?
Nope. And now I guess we'll never know, will we?
Jack shook his head. Not unless someone else was there when he sent it.
Like Bane? Asked Mark. A likely choice.
Mark breathed out his disgust.
Is Bane really going to get away with this?
All I can tell you is that he hasn't been indicted, said Jack.
Yet.
Leroy Highsmith did the cable news circuit live from Miami, Florida. Highsmith had spent the day in court-ordered mediation for another African-American family. That suit was against the North Miami Police Department, filed after an autistic child ignored an officer's command to drop his toy, and the officer, for some reason, I don't know why, he later told investigators, shot the boy's psychiatrist, who was just trying to convince the child to come back inside the treatment facility. Highsmith was wearing his lucky settlement suit, dark blue with chalk pinstripes, which sent a message to opposing counsel to pay up fast and pay up big. His only adjustment for the television appearance on behalf of the cousin family was the pancake makeup applied by his publicist to hide a 5 o'clock shadow. He was seated in front of a green screen that projected Miami's glittering skyline to millions of television viewers. His 5-minute gig with CNN was his third of the evening.
Mr. Highsmith, what does today's indictment mean to the cousin family?
It's only the start, said Highsmith. And if you read that indictment, you will appreciate how far black people in this country have come just to get to the starting line. The indictment charges that, quote, Mark Towson, with premeditated design, did intentionally and unlawfully kill Jamal Cousin, a human being. A human being. That's standard language in a homicide indictment. But it's chilling, isn't it? When you consider how long African Americans were just 3/5 of a human being. I'm here to tell you that we will not accept 3/5 justice. We intend to see this through to the end, until there is justice in the fullest, most complete sense.
Mr. Highsmith, sources have told us that Mark Townsend, in fact, knew that the indictment was imminent before the car crash today. Do you believe that he and his fraternity brother, Cooper Bartlett, were fleeing on the interstate in anticipation of their arrest?
I can't say for sure, said Highsmith. But I have been told by someone close to the investigation that 2 suitcases packed with clothes were found in the trunk of Mr. Bartlett's car.
That could be very telling.
You bet it could, said Highsmith.
Leroy Highsmith, civil rights activist and attorney for the cousin family, thank you very much for your time.
You are most welcome.
The video connection ended and Highsmith's publicist stepped forward to check his makeup. He brushed away her hand, having had enough primping.
Leroy, come on now, she said. We have MSNBC in 11 minutes.
His cell rang and he was glad for the reprieve. The fact that it was Oliver Bolt confirmed that his intended message had gotten through to the prosecutor.
Saw you on CNN, said Bolt. What do you mean by 3/5 justice?
I'm sorry, said Highsmith. I should have been more precise. What I meant to say is that we will not accept 2/3 justice.
The state attorney was silent. Highsmith had no doubt that his position was already crystal clear, but he spelled it out anyway.
You got Mark Towson. Cooper Bartlett is in hell, where he belongs. Now I want Bane Robinson.
Bane Robinson is my star witness.
That's your problem, Oliver. Not mine.
Highsmith ended the call and returned to his publicist, ready for his next cable news interview.
Chapter 36.
Wednesday morning marked a career first for Jack. A court appearance from a hospital room. Every person arrested in Florida must be brought before a judicial officer within 24 hours of arrest.
It wasn't unusual for that first appearance to occur via live video feed from a lockup facility. Jack was willing to postpone his client's initial appearance until Mark's release from the hospital. Oliver Bolt wasn't taking any chances. Or perhaps he wanted another media blast. He arranged for a live video feed from the hospital. On the right side of the split screen was Circuit Judge Kelly Simon. Somewhere in the courtroom but off-screen was the prosecutorial team. On the left side of the screen was defendant Mark Towson, sitting up in bed. Jack had debated whether to dress his client in street clothes and sit him in a chair, but that probably would have unleashed a string of public accusations that Mark was faking or exaggerating a medical condition to stay out of jail. A hospital gown in a hospital bed was the way to go. Jack stood at the rail and spoke first. "Your Honor, we waive the reading of the Miranda rights," he said.
"Very well, Mr. Towson, the charges against you are as follows."
Mark sat in silence, his head resting on the pillow as the judge recited all three counts in the indictment. In addition to first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder, Mark faced an additional charge for threatening serious bodily injury to Jamal via text message, normally a misdemeanor, but because it was racially motivated, a felony under Florida's hate crime statute.
"Mr. Towson, how do you plead?"
"I'm innocent."
"The plea will be recorded as not guilty," the judge said. "Count one is a capital offense for which there is no bond. My understanding is that the defendant is currently under armed guard in his hospital room."
"That's correct," said the state attorney.
"Upon release from the hospital, the defendant shall be immediately transported to the Sewanee County Jail, where he shall be detained through trial."
"Your Honor, the defense will be filing a motion for pretrial release," said Jack.
"In a capital case?" asked the state attorney.
"Your Honor, I've been doing this a long time, and I can't recall a single case in Sewanee County in which a capital defendant has been released on bail."
Jack knew the odds were against them.
"We want a hearing."
Judge Simon checked with his clerk. The duty judge at a first appearance didn't typically stay with the case, and Simon was checking on the assignment. "Chief Judge Calvin Teague will hear the defense's motion in his courtroom immediately upon Mr. Towson's release from the hospital." "When will that be, Mr. Switek?"
"Monday."
"Got it. Y'all should coordinate with Judge Teague's chambers for a time on Monday. Mr. Bolt, send all grand jury materials to the defense before the end of the day. Is there anything further?"
"Judge, the state of Florida will be issuing a superseding indictment to eliminate the charges against Cooper Bartlett, who is deceased."
"That's fine. Anything else?"
A note came from each end of the video feed.
"Then we are adjourned," the judge said. "Thank you."
The television screen went black. Mark looked at Jack, his expression sullen.
"So if we don't win the hearing on Monday, I'm stuck in jail, even though I haven't been convicted of anything. That's how this works? Getting out of jail before trial on a first-degree murder charge is extremely difficult. How long could it be?" "It will be several months at least, until we have a trial date."
"At least?
How long could it really be? Worst case."
Jack didn't want to dampen his client's spirits further, but he had to be honest.
"A year. Possibly longer."
"More than a year," Mark said, shaking his head.
"That means even if we go on to win at trial, my mother's last image of her son could be me behind bars in a jail uniform. Did you know that, Jack?"
"Your father told me the cancer was back. No one told me the prognosis." Mark glanced at the monitor at his bedside, as if checking his own pulse.
"Do me a favor, will you?"
"What?"
If Mom asks for my prognosis, lie to her. It could be bad. It might be both good and bad. Maybe you have no idea. No matter how terrible things look, lie to her and make it believable. You can do that, right?
Jack had never considered himself a very good liar, but sometimes it was worth the effort.
No problem, Mark. I can do that.
Chapter 37. Leroy Highsmith was back on campus at the University of Florida. That morning, he'd received notice from law enforcement that the forensic team no longer needed to restrict access to Jamal Cousins' room. By noon, he was aboard the Legal Eagle, flying to Gainesville with Jamal's mother. Lamar Cousin was traveling for work, and it fell to the family lawyer to help Edith through a task that she wasn't sure she could summon the emotional strength to finish. It was time to collect her son's belongings.
Thank you for coming with me,
said Edith. She and Highsmith were alone in the TV room of the Alpha House. Most of the 26 brothers were in the cafeteria eating lunch. Brandon Wall, the Alpha brother who testified at Mark Towson's disciplinary hearing, had stepped away to get the key to Jamal's room.
It's no trouble at all,
Highsmith told her. Structurally, the Alpha House was modest by fraternity row standards. Just one story, the simple stucco on-frame construction, was in the unremarkable architectural style of Florida circa 1975. But nobody pledged Alpha for the building. The Florida chapter was one of the smallest nationwide, but it still logged more community service hours than any other Greek organization on campus. Brandon entered the room, key in hand.
I can walk you back.
They followed him down the hallway, passing several rooms until they stopped at a door marked President. On the wall, right outside the door, was a traditional Divine Nine poem that Highsmith had recited at least 100 times, mostly at funerals, lately for his aging fraternity brothers. Success is failure turned inside out. The silver tint of the clouds of doubt. So stick to the fight when your heart is hit. It's when things seem worst that you mustn't quit. The author was anonymous, like so many brothers, thought Highsmith, who were taken down to the river and never returned.
This was my room last year when I was president, said Brandon. None of us has been inside since Jamal passed. I made sure of it.
He inserted the key and turned the lock, leaving the door closed.
We could take it from here, Brandon, said Highsmith. Okay, I'll be in the dining room if you need anything.
Brandon retraced their steps down the hallway, leaving them alone outside Jamal's room.
Take your time, Edith, said Highsmith. Go through that door when you're good and ready.
Can you open it, please?
Highsmith turned the knob and pushed the door slowly. They stood in the doorway for a moment, and then Edith reached inside and switched on the light. She took a tentative step forward, and then another. Slowly, she made it to the center of the room. Highsmith remained in the doorway, watching in silence as Jamal's mother absorbed every detail of her son's room. She walked to his desk and touched the books he'd been reading. She ran her finger along his chair. She knelt at the footlocker where he kept his basketball shoes, and she laid her hand on the Alpha jersey that was neatly folded on the shelf. The framed photograph on the wall held her attention longest. Jamal was dead center in a team of five black men dressed all in black, from boots to berets, bright stage lights shining down on them.
Alpha took first place last spring at the Soul Steppin' Contest, said Edith.
Step dancing has a long-standing tradition among black fraternities, though percussive dance was becoming mainstream enough to find its way into everything, from presidential inaugurations to Olympic ceremonies.
Teams spent hours rehearsing for annual competitions, perfecting choreographies in which the entire body is an instrument of footsteps, spoken word, and hand claps. Highsmith loved tradition as much as anybody, but his personal preference would have been less Stefan and more of what the Divine Nine were really about. Edith walked to the bed, peeled back the comforter, and took Jamal's pillow in her arms. She held it the way a mother might embrace a newborn, almost inhaling it. She placed it back on the bed and then did the same with the other pillow. Her eyes brightened with a hint of a smile. "Flower bomb," she said in a voice loud enough for Highsmith to hear.
"I'm sorry, what did you say, Edith?"
"It's a perfume. I'm one of those dreaded spritzers at the mall that you run away from during the Christmas shopping season. I do it every year for a little extra money around the holidays."
Her third job, thought Highsmith.
"I can name every perfume on the planet just by scent." Edith inhaled the pillow once again. "Definitely flower bomb."
"Some pretty young thing left her scent on Jamal's pillow."
"That stinker," she said with a sad smile.
"I didn't,"
she stopped, her sadness slipping into grief.
"I didn't even know my baby had a girlfriend."
She was on the verge of breaking down in a big way, and Highsmith went to her.
"Hey, hey now. It's okay."
Edith sniffed back tears, speaking in a raw voice. "People expect me to be happy. I suppose, now that there's an indictment."
"I'm not. I'm not at all happy."
"I understand."
She breathed out, collecting herself.
"You know, I never had a father growing up. I was just a baby when he got killed in Vietnam. 5 years later, when Mama died, people called me an orphan. They have a name for a child who loses her parents."
Highsmith just listened.
"But there's no word for a parent who loses her only child. Not in English. Not in any language. Did you know that?"
"I did not."
"Neither did I," she said, "till this happened. But there's a reason I think there's no such word."
Highsmith waited, letting her finish the thought. Her eyes welled as she looked straight at him.
"It's too horrible a thing to pack into a single word."
"That's what I think, Leroy.
Too horrible."
He moved closer and held her in his arms, gently trying to stop her from shaking.
"I believe you're right, Edith. You are absolutely right."
Chapter 38.
The Monday morning journey from Gainesville to Live Oak was nothing short of harrowing. It wasn't technically a first appearance, but it would be Jack's first time in an actual courtroom with the most reviled accused criminal in the state of Florida. The ordeal started outside the hospital. Mark was able to walk with minimal discomfort, but a wheelchair was required for discharge of a surgery patient. Mark was seated, dressed in the clothes that the state attorney had sent for his court appearance, a Suwanee County jail uniform. Mark's hands were cuffed behind his back, forcing him to sit awkwardly in the chair in a forward position, with his head lowered in shame, the media would later observe. Two police officers, one on each side of the wheelchair, escorted them through the main lobby and into the morning sun. The crowd outside the hospital, mostly students, extended well beyond the main entry area and into the parking lot. Jack estimated the turnout to be at least double what he'd seen at the courthouse for the state attorney's announcement of the indictment. The chant was louder, and the message had changed.
Lock him up. Lock him up. Lock him up.
Media swarmed and demonstrators howled as the wheelchair stopped at the squad car. The officers put the prisoner in the back seat. Jack assured Mark that they would meet up in the courtroom, and the door slammed shut. Jack ignored the media's requests for comment as the squad car pulled away. He walked quickly to the Towson's SUV and climbed in the front passenger seat. Mark's father was at the wheel. His mother and sister were in the back seat.
"So here we go," said Tucker.
A sea of demonstrators parted for the squad car, and the SUV rolled forward at a snail's pace, traveling in law enforcement's wake. The chants continued. Lock him up. Mark's mother looked out the window.
There's not a single person who believes Mark is innocent. Is there, Jack?
Jack remembered the promise that he'd made to Mark after the first appearance.
That'll change, Liz. It'll take time, but it will change.
The main courtroom in the Suwanee County Courthouse was packed for the 1 o'clock hearing. The only empty seats were in the 12-person box for a jury yet to be selected. The prosecutorial team was at the mahogany table to the judge's left. Directly behind the state attorney on the other side of the rail were Jamal's parents. Leroy Highsmith was with them. Jack and his client were at the defense table to the judge's right. Behind them was Mark's family. Members of the media filled the rest of the first row of public seating. The remaining bench seats were for the lucky few who had arrived early enough to snag a spot. Hundreds of demonstrators waited outside the courthouse. The judge greeted everyone and began without delay.
"We are here this afternoon at the request of the defendant Mark Towson, who seeks pretrial release on bail."
Circuit Judge Calvin Teague was the oldest judge in Suwanee County. Among local criminal defense lawyers, he was euphemistically referred to as Father Time, partly because he was a gray old man in a black robe, and mainly because anyone unlucky enough to be sentenced by him went away for a long, long time.
"Mr. Bolt, have you prepared an Arthur package?"
Arthur referred to the Florida Supreme Court decision State versus Arthur, which requires the prosecution to present evidence of the accused's guilt in order to hold him without bail. Typically, much of the evidence was in the form of affidavits, which were part of the Arthur package. Bolt rose and buttoned his suit jacket.
"We have a partial package, Your Honor."
The judge scowled.
"Partial? What are you waiting for? The hearing started 2 minutes ago. You should have filed it this morning." "At this time, the state of Florida seeks a continuance of this hearing. We would ask that it be rescheduled 2 weeks from today."
Jack rose immediately. "Judge, the defense is ready to proceed. Any delay is extremely prejudicial to my client."
"Well, I don't know about that,"
the judge said.
"It's been less than a week since Mr. Townsend's arrest. In a homicide case, it's not unusual for the accused to sit in jail 2 or 3 weeks before he gets an Arthur hearing. Mr. Bolt, what is the reason for the requested continuance?"
"Your Honor, just this morning the Sheriff's Department obtained new evidence in this investigation. The extra time is needed for forensic analysis."
Jack could almost feel the media breathing down his neck in the public seating behind him. It was possible that the prosecutor was bluffing and merely stalling. There was only one way to find out.
"Judge, all I'm hearing is a vague claim of newly discovered evidence. The court should demand more specificity before delaying this hearing."
"That's a fair point, Mr. Switek. How about it, Mr. Bolt? What kind of new evidence are we talking about?" "As the court knows, the evidence of guilt that the prosecution must present at an Arthur hearing has to be convincing.
This new evidence could be the most convincing of all. We have uncovered physical evidence that may place Mr. Towson at the scene of the crime.
A chorus of whispers traveled through the courtroom, and Jack could only surmise that the gist of it was, "See, I told you he did it." Mark leaned closer, speaking softly. "There's no way."
Jack wasn't so certain, but he kept applying the pressure.
"Judge, it sounds like this new evidence has already been collected and sent to the lab. If that's the case, the prosecution should just tell us what it is."
"It's a crock," said Bolt,
choosing not to wait for the judge's command.
"I beg your pardon?
Those foam shoes that started out as beachwear but now people wear all the time? Crock is the trade name."
"Ah, got it," the judge said. "I thought you meant, well, never mind. Continue, Mr. Bolt." "The sheriff's department sent its dive team back to the river this past weekend for a second look. Again, they searched the area where Jamal's body was found. This time they uncovered a crock that was buried in the muck."
An ironic refrain crackled in Jack's brain like lightning. If the crock doesn't fit, you must acquit. "This could be good for us," he whispered to his client. Judge Teague leaned back in his leather chair, thinking,
"This seems like a significant development. I don't see it as the end of the world to postpone this hearing as requested."
Jack was back on his feet.
"The defense has no problem with a postponement if Mr. Towson is released on bail until the hearing."
"We oppose that," said Bolt.
"On what grounds?" asked the judge.
"Mr. Towson is a serious flight risk. Just a few hours before the grand jury returned its indictment, I called Mr. Swiatek. He gave me his word that his client would surrender if indicted. 2 hours later, Mr. Towson and his friend Cooper Bartlett were speeding onto the expressway. The car crashed. Sadly, Mr. Bartlett was killed."
"They were not in flight," said Jack. "They were being chased by a group of young men who had threatened Cooper Bartlett at a fast food restaurant."
"That's a nice story," said the prosecutor, "but I have an affidavit from the state trooper who arrived on the scene of the accident. He found 2 duffel bags in the trunk of the car. The bags were packed."
Bolt approached the bench and handed up the affidavit to the judge, providing a copy to Jack on his way back to his seat. Jack read it quickly and then conferred with his client, who had the answer. Jack provided it to the court.
"Judge, the duffel bags were packed with Mr. Bartlett's belongings. The Theta House was burned down in a riot. The bags contained everything that Mr. Bartlett managed to salvage after the fire."
"Now the defense is just making things up," said Bolt.
"Mr. Bartlett is obviously unavailable to tell us the real reason why those bags were packed."
Jack was about to respond, but the judge stopped him, raising his hand like a traffic cop.
"I've heard enough. The state of Florida's request for a 2-week continuance is granted. The request for temporary release before the hearing is denied. Mr. Towson, you are hereby remanded into custody at the Suwannee County Jail in Live Oak. We are adjourned," he said,
ending the proceedings with a bang of his gavel.
"All rise!"
The bumps and thuds of a packed gallery filled the courtroom as Judge Teague stepped down from the bench and walked to the side door. Jack glanced at Mark and saw nothing but terror in his eyes.
"I'm going to jail,"
Mark whispered, incredulous. The side door opened and the judge disappeared into his chambers. The media dashed to the rail like sprinters out of the blocks. Others in the crowd applauded as the law enforcement officers approached the defense table and cuffed Mark's hands behind his back. Mark's family was standing behind the rail. He glanced in their direction, then back at Jack.
"I'm going to jail,"
he said, as the certainty of it finally hit him. Jack faced him squarely, looking him right in the eye.
"I'll push to get you in solitary confinement. You'll feel safer there, but
It probably won't happen the first night. It all depends on space available.
Okay.
If you talk to anyone in jail, you talk only about things like the food, the weather, or Florida football. This is very important. Do you understand me?
Mark nodded.
Let's go, said one of the officers. Mark stopped to get a hug from his mother, which was the shot of the day for at least a dozen photographers and cameramen.
If you have pain, baby, you ask for a doctor to check your incision,
Elizabeth Townsend told him.
And call us whenever you can.
Jack watched as the officers led his client away, ignoring the flurry of questions from the media. Then his gaze shifted to the other side of the courtroom, to the rail behind the prosecutor's table, where the state attorney was offering consolation to Jamal's mother. Leroy Highsmith put himself between Jamal's mother and the media, forcing the news gatherers to respect a ring of privacy around Edith Cousin. Full and complete justice, Jack heard the family's lawyer tell the reporters. That's all we seek. Chapter 39. Jack drove the SUV back to Gainesville. Mark's parents wanted to be near their son in case of an overnight emergency and took a motel room in Live Oak. Mark's sister needed to get back to UF for classes. Jack agreed to drive her, promising to have the SUV back the next morning for visitation hour at Sewanee County Jail.
I'm really worried about Mark, said Shelley.
Those were her first words of the trip, breaking 20 minutes of pensive silence from the passenger seat.
There's no reason for anyone to worry, Jack said, trying to sound believable. His surgeon said it will take 6 weeks for him to fully heal. I've already arranged for Mark to have regular doctor visits. What if someone punches him in the stomach? That won't happen. How do you know?
He didn't. If something bad happens, Live Oak Regional Medical Center is just 5 minutes away. It's a surgical hospital. It was the best Jack could do to allay her concerns, but 5 minutes was an eternity for someone locked in a jail cell with internal bleeding. They reached the campus around 4:30. On the way to Shelley's class, they passed the Theta House, or what was left of it. The red brick building hadn't completely burned to the ground. The rear had suffered only smoke damage, but the front was a charred shell. A pair of plantation-style columns had failed in the fire, causing a section of the roof to collapse. The nearby oak trees would survive, but the largest one was scorched and leafless on one side. Blackened debris was scattered across the lawn, including the Greek letters that had once identified the house as Theta Pi Omega. A temporary chain-link fence surrounded the property, and posted signs warned would-be trespassers.
What are the cops doing there?
Asked Shelley. Jack hadn't noticed any squad cars as they passed. He glanced back through the rear window and spotted three of them behind the house. Shelley had a little time before her class, so Jack turned at the next street and drove around to the back of the house. In addition to the squad cars, a forensics truck from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement was on the scene. Up the hill behind the house were several media vans from local news outlets. Jack parked and Shelley waited in the SUV as he walked down the pathway to the sheriff's deputy, who was posted at the chain-link fence.
No entry, he told Jack.
Jack identified himself as Mark Townsend's lawyer. It was immediately clear that another search was underway.
Do you have a warrant? You own this property?
Asked the officer.
I want to see the warrant, said Jack.
No can do.
Jack was in no mood for games. He dialed the state attorney, who took his call.
Oliver, I'm at the Theta House. What are you searching for?
Nothing. At least not anymore. I just spoke to the search team leader. They found it.
Jack looked beyond the fence. Several investigators were standing at the rear entrance and talking in a group.
Found what?
Jack asked.
The other croc, said Bolt.
Jack's pulse quickened.
You found a croc that matches the one you mentioned in court?
Is that what you're telling me?
I'll let you know about the match just as soon as the lab confirms it.
Where exactly was it found?
Upstairs, said the state attorney. In Bane Robinson's closet.
Not in Mark's room. Jack could breathe again.
When are you dropping the charges against my client?
Ha! Right. Just because Mark Towson had an accomplice doesn't make him any less guilty.
I've reviewed the grand jury materials, said Jack. Bane Robinson testified that Mark bragged to him about lynching Jamal. That's a lie. And that's the best evidence you've got against Mark.
Wrong. That's the best evidence I presented to the grand jury.
If you have more, I want to see it.
You will, said Bolt. I have to be socially responsible. If I backed up the dump truck and unloaded my entire case against Mark Towson in one shot, we'd have a full-blown race riot.
Bullshit. If you released everything, we'd know you rushed to an indictment.
You will receive all the materials that the defense is entitled to, I promise you that.
I want it before the bail hearing.
Sure, said Bolt. That won't be a problem.
It was a more reasonable response than expected. Jack would be sure to confirm it in writing.
Are you going back to the grand jury to indict Bane?
Do you represent Mr. Robinson?
You know the answer to that question.
Then you know I can't answer.
Should I ask Leroy Highsmith?
There was silence on the line, but somehow the state attorney's anger came through.
What kind of question is that, Swiatek?
Let me ask it another way, said Jack. Look at the last 24 hours. Highsmith publicly demands full and complete justice. Divers suddenly pull a croc out of the river muck. The other croc rises from the ashes of the Theta House, and voila! Bane Robinson is Mark's accomplice, even though it's been less than a week since he told a grand jury that Mark acted alone. You tell me, Oliver. What the hell is going on?
I never said Bane Robinson is a perfect witness. He's a rat who ratted out another rat. I've been telling jurors this for years. When you look in the sewer, you don't see swans.
Nice metaphor. Just one problem, Oliver.
Yeah, what?
You're so eager to throw Mark into the sewer, you're willing to ignore the fact that he's never been near the river.
Silence again, but without the anger.
Good night, Swiatek. I'll talk to you soon.
Yes, said Jack. You will.
Chapter 40 Mark Towson's life behind bars started in a holding pen with seven other inmates, each waiting for assignment to one of 150 beds in shared cells. Suwanee County Jail was as secure as any maximum security state prison, suitable for inmates awaiting trial for the most violent crimes, rape, robbery, even capital murder. Cameras and electronic detention operated throughout the facility. Fencing was topped with razor wire. Correctional officers were armed with mace and trained to use physical force to protect themselves and other inmates from violence.
Dinner time,
the correctional officer announced. It was a soggy bologna and cheese sandwich that smelled too awful to eat. Mark wished he wasn't so hungry. Over a period of hours, he'd climbed up and down stairs, been shackled, unshackled, and shackled again. The jail nurse applied a waterproof bandage to his incision so that he could take the required delousing shower. A body search by a male correction officer followed, which wasn't pleasant at all. Fingerprinting took another hour. The mugshot was the final indignity, a deer-in-the-headlights classic that was sure to end up all over the Internet. Mark spent the dinner hour watching a cellmate tear his bologna sandwich into pieces, roll them into balls, and one by one pitch them into the community toilet from behind the imaginary three-point line. Around 8 o'clock, the guard returned.
Got a bed for you, Towson.
Mark went to the door of the holding pen, but it didn't open. The guard's radio crackled and he walked away without explanation. Mark waited and waited. An hour passed. 90 minutes. Finally, a different guard returned.
Let's go, Towson.
The metal door opened and the guard led Mark down the corridor. Another buzzer sounded, and the iron door slid open. It was 10 p.m., and the jail was in lockdown for the night.
Mine solitary?
Asked Mark.
Nope.
My lawyer said I might be, for safety reasons.
This ain't the Holiday Inn, pal. We're at full capacity.
Another guard joined them, and the pair of correctional officers led Mark down the long corridor, iron bars on either side. A cat call from one of the inmates triggered Mark's darkest fears. The whistler was deep within one of the blackened cells, unidentifiable. They stopped at the third door from the end of the cell block. The jail cells that Mark had seen on television usually had solid metal doors, but this one had old-fashioned steel bars. Enough light shone from the corridor to reveal a man in the lower bunk. The top bunk was empty. The guard rattled the bars with his nightstick. The bright white beam of his flashlight hit the sleeping inmate in the eyes.
Up against the wall, Bulldog,
he said. Bulldog. The inmate rolled out of the bunk and did as he was told. The lead guard radioed the door control booth. A buzzer sounded. The cell door slid open automatically. Mark entered the cell in silence. Another buzz, and the door closed with the clank of metal echoing off concrete floors and walls of painted cinder block.
Bulldog here is our resident neo-Nazi, the guard said. You two should get along just fine, Towson.
Mark heard the guard snickering as they walked away. He turned to face his cellmate, who was shirtless, their eyes locked from opposite ends of a cell. Mark was sharing a cage 7 feet wide and 12 feet deep with a man who was built like a football player and who was covered in enough tattoos for the entire team. Bulldog stole the clean pillow from the top bunk, tossed the one he'd been using onto the floor, and climbed into the bottom bunk.
You're up top.
Mark debated whether to stand up for himself and say something about the pillow switch. He didn't. He picked up the dirty one from the floor and climbed into the top bunk. With hands clasped behind his head, he lay staring up the ceiling. The lights from the corridor were just bright enough for him to discern traces of prison artwork on the wall. Some of it was in black marker, some in pencil. There was a calendar to count down the days, so faded that it could have predated Mark's birth. Someone with a knack for portraits had sketched out a nude Latina from memory or imagination. There were also gang symbols and a swastika.
So I hear you lynched a nigger,
said Bulldog from below. Mark didn't respond.
That's okay, said Bulldog. That's cool with me.
Mark still didn't answer. Bulldog pushed up on Mark's mattress, nearly knocking Mark out of the top bunk.
What's wrong with you? Your mama never taught you to speak when spoken to? I didn't kill anyone,
said Mark.
Well, that's too bad, said Bulldog. Because if you did it, you and me are going to be good friends.
Mark didn't say a word.
And if you didn't,
he said, sighing loudly enough for Mark to hear him.
Well, if you didn't, then,
to me, you're just another warm fuckhole.
Mark went cold.